Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the November 10th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesday of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. First, I want to thank all of you who called in and subscribed during our fall fund drive when Joy DeClaire of Forthright Radio and I were on the air asking for your pledges to support our programs and this listener-sponsored radio station. Your support during a difficult economic period was gratifying to all of us, and we plan to continue to bring you the programming that has earned your loyal support over the years. Today is no exception. About 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking once again with an old friend in Paris. Actually, she's in Brussels today, Diana Johnston, who has been writing and speaking on European affairs for a number of years in his most recent article on Counterpunch, French Fury in the EU Cage, on October 21st, was the best description of the recent wave of French strikes that I have seen. And that most recent movement of the French working class against the government of President Nicolas Sarkozy is what we'll be talking about today. For those of you who might have retained some hopes that last Tuesday's election would bring the U.S. closer to ending its horrible misadventures in Afghanistan and Iraq, listening to KZYX over the weekend must have had a sobering effect. Last Saturday morning, many of you may have heard the moving interview between Scott Simon and Joint Chief of Staff Mike Mullen and his wife concerning the growing rate of suicides among U.S. troops in the country as the country continues the longest wars in its history and U.S. servicemen and women have faced a series of repeated deployments that is without historical precedent. Not only have the suicide rates increased, Mrs. Mullen noted, the number of homeless vets has begun to replicate what the country experienced in the aftermath of the Vietnam War. Like me, I suspect that many of you were waiting for Simon, speaking sympathetically to the Mullins, to ask the Chief of Staff two questions that needed asking. Are these wars worth it? And when are they going to end? Then on Sunday, on This American Life, the program stepped away from American Life to explore what the U.S. did in and to Iraq. The program was entitled Iraq After Us, and listeners were treated to telling interviews with a variety of Iraqis as well as American officers who worked with them. In sum, we destroyed that country. It was a powerful program, and if you missed it, you could find it online. I have noticed, but never mentioned it before, but November is the month in which a number of momentous historical events have taken place. Today, November 10th, is the 100th anniversary of the Mexican Revolution. On this day in 1910, the Mexican people launched their war to overthrow the dictator Porfirio Diaz. Last Saturday, November 7th, marked the 93rd anniversary of the beginning of what came to be called the October Revolution in Russia, with an uprising in what was then Petrograd, which came to be called after the revolution Leningrad, after its leader Vladimir Lenin, and which, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, has since been returned to an earlier name, St. Petersburg. By the Russian calendar, the Bolshevik uprising actually took place on October 25th, but everywhere else it was November 7th, 1917. In past years, the day was a time for celebration in the old Soviet Union and among its supporters, but now it comes and goes without any public notice. Yesterday and today marked the 72nd anniversary of Kristallnacht, the night of the broken glass, when Nazi stormtroopers and German civilians ransacked and destroyed Jewish homes and businesses in Germany and parts of Austria, sparked by the assassination of German diplomat Ernst von Rath by Herschel Greenspan, a German-born Polish Jew in Paris. 91 Jews were killed in the two-day period and 30,000 hauled off to concentration camps. Tomorrow, the 11th, will mark 92 years since the guns fell silent in Europe and World War I came to an end, with 15 million soldiers dead on both sides. At the end of the month, on November 29th, it will be 63 years since the UN General Assembly passed a non-binding vote that was intended to partition Palestine into separate Jewish and Arab states. The Palestinians, who were far more numerous than Jews at the time and controlled more than two-thirds of the country, refused to accept the partition, and the rest is history. There was another November event which was intimately linked to all but the Mexican Revolution, which rarely gets the attention it deserves. It was on November 2nd, 1917, that British Foreign Secretary Lord Arthur Balfour issued a letter to Sir Walter Rothschild, in which he wrote, "His Majesty's government views with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country." End quote. The letter violated an earlier promise made in writing by Sir Henry McMahon to Arab leader Sharif Hussein that promised the peoples of the Middle East their independence if they joined in the war to defeat the Turks and end 4 centuries of occupation by the Ottoman Empire. The efforts to set up what in 1948 became the State of Israel was resisted from the very beginning by Palestine's Muslim and Christian inhabitants. Trying to keep the two sides from fighting while enabling the Zionists to establish Jewish settlements gave the British nothing but headaches, presaging the problems that face the U.S. in dealing with Israel and the Palestinian Arabs today. A view of the historical record, including the Foreign Office and Colonial Office correspondence at the time, makes it appear that the British got nothing for their role in allowing the beginnings of a Jewish state to thrive. The theory that its support of the Zionist project was part of Imperial Britain's plan to control the Middle East, which is the explanation usually offered by the left, is not backed by any evidence, and the widely accepted notion that it was in payment for Zionist leader Chaim Weizmann's invention of acetone, which aided the British war industry, was discounted by Weizmann himself. Why then did the British issue the Balfour Declaration? The answer was explained by Edward Cavendish, the 10th Duke of Devonshire, who succeeded Winston Churchill as Secretary of State. In a memorandum circulated to the British Cabinet in 1993, designed to explain the government's policy regarding Palestine, Cavendish began by writing, quote, "Briefly stated, the object of the declaration was to enlist the sympathies on the Allied side of influential Jews and Jewish organizations all over the world. It is arguable that the negotiations with the Zionists, which had been processed for many months before the declaration was actually published, did, in fact, have considerable effect in advancing the date at which the United States government intervened in the war. However that may be, it must always be remembered that the declaration was made at a time of extreme peril to the cause of the Allies. The Balfour Declaration was a war measure designed to secure tangible benefits which it was hoped could contribute to the ultimate victory of the Allies. These benefits may or may not have been worth securing, and may or may not have been actually secured, but the objections on going back on a promise made under such conditions is obvious. The Jews would naturally regard it as an act of baseness if, having appealed to them in our hour of peril, we were to throw them over for when the danger was past." End quote. What the Duke of Devonshire was carefully referring to was the fact that when the negotiation between the Zionists and the British began, the British and the French were losing the war. Since Britain and France were allied with Tsarist Russia, where the Jews were severely repressed, the leaders of the European and American Jewish communities, as well as the bankers, would take no sides in the conflict. With the abdication of the Tsar in February 1917, the most important barrier to Jewish support had been removed, and in the U.S., the leading American Zionist, Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, led on by the British, began pressuring his friend President Wilson to go back on the pledge he had made to the voters in 1916 that he would keep the United States out of the war. Believing that the Zionists would succeed with Wilson, the new British Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, turned down a German peace offer, which would have brought the war to an end with no change in the borders. What is generally not known is that Lloyd George, while a member of Parliament, had served as a lawyer for the Zionist organization in London going back to 1903, and consequently was quite sympathetic with their efforts, which was not the case with Lord Herbert Asquith, who preceded him. Anyway, on April 2, 1917, the U.S. declared war on Germany and effectively saved Britain and France from defeat. Edward Bernays, the nephew of Sigmund Freud and the father of modern propaganda, was enlisted to build public support for the war, and soon George M. Cohan's "The Yanks Are Coming" was on everybody's lips. Of course, the irony is clear. Had the British accepted the German peace offer, there would have been no punitive Versailles Agreement following the war. Germany would not have experienced the devastating effects which fertilized the soil that gave rise to Adolf Hitler and the Third Reich and the war that he launched in revenge. And there would have been no Jewish Holocaust. This seems to be confirmed by Samuel Landsman, a leading British Zionist who was involved in the negotiations that led to the Balfour Declaration. In 1936, in a pamphlet entitled Great Britain, the Jews in Palestine, after describing in considerable detail how the declaration came into being, Landsman concluded, quote, "The fact that it was Jewish help that brought USA into the war on the side of the Allies has rankled ever since in German, especially Nazi minds, and has contributed in no small measure to the prominence which anti-Semitism occupies in the Nazi program," end quote. That was 2 years before Kristallnacht. I am sure that what I have just read will be disturbing to many listeners who have not been accustomed to hearing or reading the truth about this particular critical episode in the history of the last century that is still impacting the world today. Only yesterday we have seen Israeli Prime Minister declare once again that the U.S. must make Iran believe that it represents a credible military threat to attack it, to convince Iran to give up its nuclear program. Benjamin Netanyahu's statement required Defense Secretary Robert Gates to issue a lame statement that Washington was still counting on sanctions to do the job. Netanyahu was speaking in New Orleans, where he was attending a meeting of the Jewish Federations of North America, in New Orleans. Also in attendance and delivering an impassioned speech to the delegates was Vice President Joe Biden, playing his usual role of lickspittle when speaking to an American Jewish or Israeli audience. U.S. support for Israel must continue forever, said Biden. When it comes to Israel's security, there can be no daylight between Israel and the United States, end quote. Meanwhile, his ostensible boss, President Obama, cautioned yesterday that Israel's plan to construct 1,300 new homes in East Jerusalem could obstruct the pursuit of peace in the Middle East. Said Obama, "This kind of activity is never helpful when it comes to peace negotiations," adding that he was concerned Israel and Palestinians were not making enough of an effort to advance peace negotiations. Netanyahu's response was a curt, "Jerusalem is not a settlement." That's how New York Times reported it, and Obama still unable or unwilling to tell Israel what it can and cannot do while giving sharp advice to everyone else. And it should be mentioned that immediately after the 1967 war, Israel expanded Jerusalem to 3 times its original size and annexed that territory, which no country has yet recognized. Also, it should be noted, that the standard international protocol that applies to heads of states obliges them to get an invitation before traveling to another country. This has never seemed to apply to Israeli prime ministers or presidents. They come and go in the U.S. as they please. One of the more prescient observers of Israel-U.S. relations is a venerable Israeli journalist and former Knesset member, the 87-year-old Ori Avneri. "For 2 years now," Avneri writes, "Netanyahu has succeeded in thwarting every effort by Barack Obama to compel him to start a real peace process. He has defeated him at every turn, time after time. Now Obama has suffered a stinging setback at home, and a new chapter has begun. A big question mark is now hanging over Obama's future. He is in danger of becoming a one-term president. From now on, he will be compelled to devote all his time and energy to his effort to get reelected. In such a situation, he cannot afford to provoke AIPAC and run the risk of losing the votes and the money of the Jews. As to the Congress, as far as Israel is concerned," writes Avneri, "there is no change. The senators and congressmen dance to the tune of the Israel lobby. And in this respect, there's no difference between Democrats and Republicans. It crosses party lines," as one of the leaders of the lobby recently boasted. "Almost all the experts believe that the unlimited American support for Israel is the main cause for the Islamic anti-American wave," Avneri notes. "Most of them do not speak about this openly because fear of the Israeli lobby pervades the entire American political establishment. But even the most terrifying lobby cannot withstand in the long run the inexorable logic of national interests, end quote. That's Israeli Uri Avneri giving us a... Diana Johnstone is a veteran journalist who has been based in Paris for many years. She has written for a number of international publications and most recently for Counterpunch. She is also the author of Fool's Crusade, Yugoslavia, NATO, and Western Delusions, which provides an analysis of the U.S.-led war to destroy Yugoslavia that one rarely hears in the U.S. The last time I interviewed Diana was from her apartment in Paris, but this morning I reached her in Brussels. Hello, good evening, Diana. Welcome to Takes on the World.
Well, good evening here. Good morning to you.
It is good. Well, it'd be nice to be in Brussels and share some muscles, some Brussels. this seems like a good time to speak with you again because French President Nicolas Sarkozy has just signed the pension reform bill that the Parliament approved in the face of weeks of crippling strikes by French workers combined with students. What was it about the nature of this pension reform legislation that moved the country to protest in a manner that I don't think has been seen in France since 1968?
Well, the one thing that is essential about it is that it's an issue that affects virtually everybody. There's a lot of dissatisfaction with the whole direction of economic policy in under this government, and actually already under previous governments. This is a continual policy of, in fact, drastically reducing the income of ordinary working people in order to please what they call the markets, meaning the financial markets, meaning the financial sector. And this is only one of a series, but it's an issue that really affects everybody because, except, well, those who never plan to work at all, but all working people are concerned by the issue of retirement. So this is one reason that it had such a reaction, but also it's an accumulated effect of very great dissatisfaction with this government.
Well, this has been actually going on. There's a dissatisfaction with Sarkozy seemingly since he became elected, and particularly, I guess, his social life also has had an effect on the people when they see the reports of him and his socialite or his fashion plate wife winging around and having a time of their life while the people are struggling.
Well, that doesn't help, that's for sure. It helps explain why his personal popularity has sunk to, I think it's in the 20s, which is very, very low indeed. Because, and also his manner is extremely unpleasant. He speaks always in this very, I'm telling you this, as if he were scolding naughty children. He has this very unpleasant manner. And all of that, while, of course, it is known that he favors the rich, it isn't just that he has a lifestyle with the rich, but, of course, his policies have been to reduce their taxes or even to ignore their wealth, as was this case of this big scandal all summer around a very colorful scandal around Lilian Bettencourt, the richest woman in France, the heiress to the L'Oréal cosmetics fortune, who hired the wife of Eric Werth, who was the budget minister at the time, and he is supposed to be looking after taxation, and her taxes were way.
Hello.
Declared. Yeah. Hello.
Yeah. Repeat that. And just, yeah. What happened with their taxes? Yeah.
Well, they just were underdeclared. I mean, she owns this island off in the Indian Ocean, all sorts of things. The properties were all declared way below their value, and he had his wife working on her staff. And he is now the minister of labor, who actually introduces reform. So while he's helping the rich get richer, he's introducing a reform to make working people get poorer. It's just really too much.
How has the French media responded to this?
Oh, they're totally in favor of the reforms, of course. You see, the media is just speaks with one voice now. It's always worrying about we have to please the financial markets. I think the whole West is like this. In as much as the financial markets or the finances more or less own the media, the media all sing the same song. And so the media, they may criticize Sarkozy personally here and there these days because I think they're getting ready to switch horses for the next presidential electoral race in 2012. I think there's a shift away from Sarkozy personally for these personal reasons, but that doesn't mean that they'll want any different policy. This is the only policy. There is no alternative policy. We must have policies that please the markets, and that means constantly creating conditions that please the financial markets and while ruining the country.
And this is the general policy of the European Union.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, these reforms they were introduced by the Sarkozy government, but in fact, they're part of they're carrying out a 2003 European Union report on what needs to be done about retirement. So in fact, you see now economic policy is made really at the European Union level, and then the various member states are called upon to carry it out. And regardless of their own domestic situation. Now, the situation of France is quite different from in many significant ways from the situation in England or Germany or other member states. But they all must have the same policy in this European Union. So this is creating in France a great deal of undercover resentment against the European Union. But of course, the media are totally in favor of the European Union because that is, in fact, it's globalization, European version. It's all part of the same turning over all countries to the finance. And in fact, of course, it kills democracy because the major decisions are all taken by these markets, meaning the financial powers.
My guest is Diana Johnston. We're speaking with her from Brussels about the situation in France and the European Union in general. When the economies of all the European countries were flying high, I guess the people loved the European Union, but now it seems, as in the headline in your article and Counterpunch on October 21st, which is still online, I recommend it, it's French fury in the EU cage, as if the people in France, and by implication, the people in Europe, are trapped within this the European Union now. Instead of being freed by it, they're now in a trap.
Well, some feel in the trap, and some are quite happy to be in the trap. And some think they're not in the trap. Of course, the most unhappy are the Greeks, for reasons that I won't go into here, but because they have found themselves in great difficulty, and being in the European Union is no help as it was supposed to be. But I would say I don't know that people originally were for the European Union for exactly economic reasons. It was presented as peace forever, we'll end war, Germany and France are coming together, and it was sold as really on sort of political, idealistic grounds, but it has turned into a mechanism to impose globalistic policies on Europe over their own people, And it frankly, it takes a long time for citizenry to begin to catch on to this, because the media will never let you know.
Well, actually, speaking of that, one of the things you point out, which we need to talk about, is how the Western press particularly has distorted the French protest, making it appear as if the French, that it's simply a matter of reducing the retirement age from 62 to, or pushing it from to 60, raising retirement age from 60 to 62, which people in this country would say, well, big deal. But as you point out in your article, it's much more complicated than that. Perhaps you could explain that.
Yes, that's very important because, of course, the whole thrust of the Anglo-American media in particular was to say, oh, these stupid, lazy French, because they don't want, the one thing they don't want is for France ever to be a model for anybody else. That's why it's constantly criticized and made fun of, because actually it is the most comfortable to live in country in the West, probably in the world.
I agree. Yes.
Far from being, what?
I agree.
And you see, that's an intolerable thought for Americans who, they will put up with anything because they have been told from the time they were born that they're living in the best country in the world, and everything else is inferior. So they must be thinking that. In fact, you see, French labor productivity per worker per hour is higher than the United States. It's even higher than Germany. So there is the wealth being created by labor that could pay for retirement. Then as to the retirement itself, the 62 figure is simply the age at which one can take retirement. But that means taking a reduced pension. In order, the reform means that to have a full pension, one must work till 67. And not only that, one must work over 40 years of contributions. Now, that's actually higher than in Germany or other places. So, in fact, this is not a big deal. And the other problem is that with unemployment, not many people can work until 67. Even if they want to, they can't, because the employers perhaps are going out of business. That's the whole problem of deindustrialization. Or else they're dead because they've been working too hard. Or the employers would rather hire somebody younger and, in fact, cheaper. And so this whole thing about, well, people should want to work longer, that's ridiculous, because they can't, no matter how much they want to. Not many people want to. Of course, intellectual workers usually like what they're doing, or artistic workers, you know, and are happy to go on with it. But if you're a riveter, or you're working in a coal mine or something, I think you'd be quite happy to leave a bit earlier than that. In fact, you probably wouldn't live to retire at all. That's what the figures show.
Well, that's as you mentioned, that those workers in the industries have a shorter lifespan, and so by pushing the retirement year past, it gives them much less time for retirement. One thing is interesting.
Well, that will save money, because then you don't have to pay out pensions to those people because they're dead.
They're dead. And it's interesting, you talk about the French system in your article being based on the solidarity between generations. And I find that very interesting, because we see workers and students out together, whereas in the United States, we have never seen this. It was during the Vietnam War, we had students out on the street and workers with hard hats and waving American flags defending the war. I always wonder what the American workers think when they see French workers going out in the streets and American workers having being reduced in their numbers. The unions get weaker and weaker all the time and spend more money giving to donations to the Democratic Party than they actually do organizing. It's just a different situation.
This is a paradox. Actually, the unions in France are notoriously weak and competing with each other. You know that, of course.
Yeah.
And I mean, they're very weak, and yet, despite the fact that the unions are weak, the workers are the most militant. And I think this can be explained by the fact that the strong unions tend to become bureaucratized. Their leaders tend to get co-opted into elite things in the United States. That's a great U.S. governance policy, is to take labor unions and to think, help them overthrow left-wing unions in Latin America, make them feel important that way, the leaders, I mean. And then they have strike funds that they don't want to spend. The French unions don't have any strike funds. These workers who are going on strike are losing their pay by doing it. That's something, you know, to say, oh, they're going on strike because they like to, ha, ha, ha. The fact is they're making personal sacrifices to do so.
Well, they lose pay every day they're out on strike.
Yes.
Do they have strike funds?
That's what I'm saying. They don't.
They don't.
There are no strike. The unions do not have strike funds.
They
do in the United States, but the unions here do not have strike funds. And now what has happened is that this strike has been very popular. And, for instance, the refinery workers, who have been crucial in this because they are in a strategic position to hold things up,
yes,
have been receiving checks from people just in support because the strike is very popular. So ordinary people who aren't in a position to go on strike are sending them checks to help them through.
Well, they really were able to shut the country down, essentially, by blocking the engines, the refineries, and not producing the petrol. It was an amazing example of what a general strike can do. It's a dream of certain people, a handful of people in the American labor force, but it doesn't seem to be a likelihood. Now, we see across the channel the new conservative government in Britain about to put through austerity measures that are really going to put a crimp in the British working class. Do they expect to see something, if not quite as powerful as the French worker response? Are they anticipating in Britain, worker protests?
Well, I don't know Britain very well. But I would point out that the British economy is in much worse shape than the French economy because it's been steered into services it's an economy that's based on servicing the financial sector, and it's been deindustrialized much more radically than France, and so the general economic situation of that country is much worse. And, of course, again, it's a paradox because they had very, very strong trade unions, but the Thatcher period managed to break them. And of course, the way to get rid of unions is to get rid of the industries that the unions work in. So the deindustrialization is an anti-labor policy, but, of course, it's going to ruin the country because eventually you're going to get to the point where they're not producing any wealth anymore. They're just, services and McDonald's and how are they going to pay for anything? The deindustrialization is a key problem to all this because it's that which is really causing the problem for financing pensions or anything else. That you are tearing down the economic base that paid for these things.
Well, we've actually seen deindustrialization in this country with outsourcing,
yes,
of major factories, that virtually anything that you go to buy a home building product, whether it's nails or steel pipe, is made in China. And it's interesting to when the U.S. lectures, U.S. president, whoever happens to be, lectures China about their economic policies, the reality is the both political parties are responsible for allowing U.S. industries to outsource, to runaway shop, and leave a whole working class without meaningful work. Today, it's interesting, they reported only 435,000 people applied for unemployment benefits last week. That's a week. And the week before, they were bragging about 1.1 million new jobs in 6 months. Well, if you multiply 52 by 400,000, you get over 20 million people losing their jobs every year, and they're playing these games here, which the American public doesn't seem to pay much attention to. I mean, it's the same
general pattern, and the thing is that you see what. The idea of the Western leaders who have decided on this policy is that we are so much superior, we are so brilliant and so on, that we can go on without manufacturing anything and let these lesser breeds in China or goodness knows where, you know, do the dirty work, and they just take the profit, and we will come up with new ideas and so on. But you see, the Chinese are now putting more and more money into research and development, and they're just as smart as we are, if not more so. And, of course, what is going to happen when they are the ones that have the technology as well as the rest of the jobs? I mean, what are we going to do? You see, the West is heading into its own decline. It's just plunging off the edge. The whole West.
In search of profit. The time is now 9:45. My guest is Anna Johnstone. We're going to go to your phone calls, and I see somebody has a telephone call coming in. The number here, of course, is 895-2448 or 1-800-499-7117. Let's go to a caller who's been persistently pushing that little button. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Another excellent program. Thank you.
Thank you.
Briefly, one of the things that has not been touched on yet, and I'm sure that it is an issue, at least it seems so from my distant view of all of this business that's going on in France, is this. The youth, I should imagine, are joining in the strikes because it's obvious to them that if the retirement age is extended artificially, they're going to have a tough time finding jobs when they get out of school. And the other thing, I'll leave you with this. At some point later on in the program, if you will once again announce precisely which issue of Counterpunch her article is in. I've been shuffling through my stack of Counterpunch, and I can't find the article. But I'd love it if she would comment on my observation about the young people being concerned about the future.
That's a very good question, and she did write about it. It's online October 21st.
And I get the print.
It's not in the print edition. It's on the inline edition. It's still up there, yes.
Thank you.
And did you hear the question, Dan, about the comment on that? Good point.
Hello?
Yes.
Well, he's answered the question. I mean, that's absolutely correct. And you see, it was remarkable to see these 15-year-old or so high school lycée students saying precisely that, analyzing very well what their concerns were. They're having trouble getting jobs already, and in fact, the age now of finding a job is now as high as really entering the workforce is now around 27 years old. So people are having to wait longer to get a job, and then they can count. And if they have to work over 40 years to or now they're putting up to 42 or 43 years in order to retire. That means that they'll be working until the age 70, but it may take them until they're 30 or 32 to get a job if work of older workers is prolonged. So the question answers itself. He's absolutely right, I think the government was surprised that the young people were so aware of that. They would think, Anglo-American journalists think, oh, why are these young people thinking about retirement? They should be thinking about chasing girls.
I know.
Well, it just happens that people here aren't quite so idiotic.
The problem is also a problem here. You have young people getting out of the university, which is becoming prohibitively expensive. Last year, the University of California raised its fees 32%, and they just announced yesterday they're going to raise it another 8%. And you have students, and you mentioned in Paris, in France, students forced to live with their parents until the age of 30. This has increasingly happened today, or people rooming together, but the problem is finding good jobs, as well as decent paying jobs, but that we're getting an educated workforce without the jobs.
That's a problem everywhere. So what is the answer? It's very complicated, and you really in France you could say what the answer is, to go back to what they had in the 60s and 70s and so on, is a mixed economy, so that you have certain state enterprises which provide excellent public service, like the fast trains, things that have a kind of monopoly nature, because you can't double the electricity, for instance, and these are all being privatized, which means that the profits from these public service industries goes into the international finance markets, whereas before it was reinvested in the French economy and could help to pay for things like high salaries, retirement, and so on. So if you don't have the mixed economy, I don't see how you can pay for these things. But it's now a dogma, as if it were Moses had come down with the tablets and say, you must not spend public funds for people. You must give it to private finance.
And this is the mantra here. We have another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning. Excellent program. I think there's an underlying issue here that's not just so the case with Europe, but also the states here, and many of the developing countries too, which is I think there's been a misunderstanding about the nature of what the common good means, the very underpinning of society. We've been laboring under this false notion of the individual. It's the cult of the individual. And I don't think there's really been a substantive discussion about what it is that we truly want as a people. And I think there's this interesting debate now between, you know, the relationship between money, which is it's become so strange and so disconnected in a way from what is real. I think your guest has got it exactly right. So I'd just like to see what her comments are vis-a-vis this deeper issue about what it means to be in a society, what it means to look after each other, and what it means from one perspective of the desire to compete in the world, and then the other to collaborate together.
Good question.
Thanks.
Yes. You know, that reminds me of when I was very young. I remember hearing that George Bernard Shaw had explained that he was Fabian's socialist because he didn't want to live in a society, you know, where there were a lot of poor people running around who had nothing better to do but beg or steal or something. I mean, you know, there when you see right now as unemployment is growing in France and purchasing power is going down, you are having all this problem of incivility, of youth being rude to old people, of even personal violence. You see, that is an inevitable result. And then you have the issue of security. Well, that is because there are people left out of society, and what are they going to do? They're going to be probably unpleasant to other people. So, you know, if you want to live in a society that is the jungle, I don't think you've thought very far. And so I think this business about what is the common good is very important, and I do think that for one reason or another, there's more cultural awareness of the problem in France than in some other places.
Well, we got the board lit up here, so we're going to next call. And hello, you're on the air.
Good morning. I caught the last half of this. Listen, we have a society that's built a lot on competition. And for the last 50 years, we have allowed our manufacturing base to be moved to China. China is willing to live, tend to a small apartment. And in order to compete with them, we as Americans have to be prepared to do that. Now I think it's the ultimate in hubris to sit there and go, well, I don't want to do that. Where you're willing to walk out and buy yourself an iPod or whatever cheap Chinese stuff you want to buy, it just seems to me like, guess what, guys? It's time. We can't keep this smoke and mirrors financing going on anymore. Now we have to really compete. And guess what? We've got 50 years of catching up to do. Thanks.
Thanks for your call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, well,
what comes to my mind is
Barter.
But I don't know how we'd work out the larger social services, but it seems that a barter system would alleviate a lot of this if we could work out some way for the medical and the other and the manufacturing of... It's a good question, but I think it could be ironed out anyway. That's my comment. Thank you.
Well, barter on a local basis, of course, but many people do that here, but globally it would be a little more complicated. One question I wanted to ask you, Diana, what effect has this had? Hello? Diana?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes. What effect has these problems caused on the relations or the anti-Muslim sentiment that is widespread in much of Europe?
Well, I think that it's distracted from that. I mean, I think these strikes have had a beneficial result in the sense that for a while nobody was talking about that. That's a big distraction from serious issues, you know, all of that anti-Muslim stuff. And this was a unified enough movement that... This is what you need, in fact, to overcome that kind of thing, is to have a social movement that brings people together as working people and not as members of some sort of religious community.
That's interesting because actually that question just occurred to me because in all the articles I've seen, your articles and reports on BBC and things I read on the internet, this has not been discussed at all, and it has like it. They're now realizing what the serious problems are, and not appealing to those who are trying to stir racial divisions or anti-Islam movement, which actually stems from this country largely. We're coming down to the end of the wonderful program, Diane. Any last comments, observations that you want to make, predictions about what might be going on? There's going to be another protest in later on in November. The unions have called. Is there a chance that this could eventually bring Sarkozy down before an election?
I don't think so, because I don't think that actually there's a really revolutionary movement at this point. I think that it's going to have to find some kind of electoral expression, and that's very difficult because of the fact that the Socialist Party is like the Democratic Party in the United States. I mean, it has the same policies, except the people who carry them out seem to be nicer. But it doesn't...
There or here?
Very much.
France, where they're nicer, the France or the United States?
No, nicer than Sarkozy.
Oh, okay.
It's like Democrats seem nicer than the Republicans. That was the comparison I was making. And that's why I mentioned in my article there is this renegade left socialist, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who is been the one who has really become the best spokesman for this movement. But he is completely at war with the media, totally. And he can give it back better than he gets. I mean, but they really are doing everything to black him out because he is quite able to tell them off royally for being stooges of the government, which they are. So it's very difficult because you see the media are all on the side of the government on this issue. But you remember in 2005, the media were all in favor of the yes vote for the EU treaty. But the population voted heavily against it, whereupon the political class went right ahead and against the popular will. So how long can this go on? I mean, I think we have another election. It has to be an interplay between election and protest.
And at that point, Diane, we've come to the end of the hour. I want to thank you so much for another excellent interview. I look forward to my next visit and us getting together.
Okay.
Take care.
Fine.
Bye-bye.
Take care.